Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I found out that Mark Twain quote. Said, I've been through some terrible times and terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened. Which is, yeah, when you get it right, it's Mark Twain. We received an email from Ajahn Sumedho, and in it he's reflecting on the end of this past rains retreat. He'd been on a solitary retreat, and he's reflecting on his own monastic life, and this was the end of his 46th year as a monk, and with one as a novice. He's been 47 years practicing, and he said that so he spent these 47 years contemplating the Four Noble Truths, and this past year, this past retreat, he said, is gratitude for the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha have never been stronger, and his sense of gratitude to the teachings and to the opportunity to the lay community that have supported him. So that's a really strong feature. I just thought to share that, is that you realize the power of focusing our attention on the heart of the teachings and these Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught in his very first discourse are not a small thing. When we take it on, investigate them, live them, they have the power to truly transform. And there's a certain directness to that teaching, which, you know, sometimes we either fail to appreciate or to penetrate, or we look in the way of, you know, surely there must be something else. Surely there must be something other than these Four Noble Truths. But one of the reflections I've always felt helpful was that the Buddha expressed these Four Noble Truths right after his full and complete enlightenment. This was the freshest thing in his mind. He had been liberated. He had put forth tremendous effort, energy, renunciation, and he'd reaped the fruits of that commitment. And this was the most vivid thing in his mind, and the way to express it was through these Four Noble Truths. So that the teachings, even in the Theravada, are extensive. And then when it gets to later eras of the Theravada, the movement of the Buddhist teachings to different regions, countries, the developing of different traditions. You know, there's many, many, many ways of approaching the teaching and expressing it. But to me, that kernel and core of truth, to me, that comes from those Four Noble Truths. So that it's not to be just skipped over or skimmed over or just giving a cursory nod historical teachings. This is a tool that allows us to really penetrate. There's a discourse where the Buddha states very emphatically that if someone were to think that they could free themselves or be free from suffering, be completely liberated without penetrating these Four Noble Truths, that would be an impossibility. He said it's very straight. It's just impossible to really be liberated and free without understanding and penetrating these Four Noble Truths. And the comparison he gives is in the same way, if someone were to say that they would not bother with building the lower story of a building, and then they would be able to erect the upper story with its gabled roofs above it, it's just an impossibility. And besides the kind of emphatic declaration of truth, I appreciate the Buddha's practicality. It's a building. Besides being a great enlightened master, he always also had to deal with building monasteries. So that it's a very apt image. So that these Four Noble Truths of the truth of dukkha, the sense of and sometimes it's better to just to use the word dukkha, because it has and most people are familiar with the teachings, familiar with the structure of the teachings, and the word dukkha has so many nuances, from stress to suffering to dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness, discontent, all the nuances of that which is sets one at dis-ease. And then the teachings are put into a cause and result structure. The Buddha taught from that framework, that the Four Noble Truths are that there's dukkha, there is the cause of dukkha. And the Buddha points to particular forms of desire, the tanha. And tanha, as a word, is desire that is always accompanied by greed, hatred, and delusion. People can take exception sometimes to, in the English language, they say, well, what about when I desire to do good and all of that? But the word tanha is specifically desire that is grounded in greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's inevitably going to lead to suffering, lead to dukkha. And the particular types of desire take a different shape of the way the mind moves. So that the first one being kama tanha, so sensual desire, specifically towards sensuality, gratification, that seeking of a pleasure, that is one way that desire moves. The other is bhava tanha, tanha toward becoming. Bhava is being or becoming, and it's a difficult word to translate, but it's it forms the root of our sense of being a person, being something, being anything. I mean, this is a and so that sense of desire formulating and coalescing around the identity or a sense of a state that one is trying to be in, to accomplish. And of course it's bound up with the sense of me and the sense of self. Vibhava tanha is the desire for non-becoming, non-being, the pushing away of experience, the annihilating of something that is that we don't want, either an external condition or an internal condition, how we can feel or conceive about ourselves or a particular mental state, just trying to push it away, reject it, that is vibhava tanha. So that that always ends in dukkha. That's it. That pushing and pulling, the going towards, that hope of gratification, these are all particular forms of desire and movement within the mind that fundamentally keep us off balance and discontent, dissatisfied, and not fulfilled. The cessation of dukkha is nirodha, and that is that ending or the resolution of this this conundrum, this difficulty of dukkha, that's really the goal, and the cause of that, that is the result. The cause is the fourth noble truth, which is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, and the path, eightfold path, starting from right view through to right concentration. I'm just thinking to Just to actually go to the sutta itself, and how the Buddha, in the Dhammacakka Sutta, how the Buddha describes the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha is the complete cessation, giving up, abandonment of that craving, complete release from that craving, and complete detachment from it, so that one of the things that they yesterday I mentioned Prapayuto as a great scholar and practitioner, he makes a point of, because the word Nirodha, and both in Thai as well as in English, the emphasis on in meaning is on cessation. So the cessation, the bringing things to an end. And he points to the fact that there's actually other nuances to the word Nirodha, in that it doesn't necessarily, because usually when we think of cessation, it's sort of something that exists, we have to bring it to an end. But he said with the word Nirodha can also mean sense of non-problematic. It's like it's not like in that sense of the complete cessation, giving up, abandonment of that craving, but it's sort of also the non, it ceases to be a problem, it ceases to be any kind of complication, so that when something is seen through and penetrated and understood, it's ceasing to be a problem. Dukkha ceasing to be a problem. It isn't as if there isn't any difficulty or say like the Buddha himself, fully enlightened being, still had physical pain to deal with, illness, and that couldn't have been comfortable. There's even discourses where the Buddha asked others to, he'd been teaching for a while, and he asked others to continue the teaching because his back is bothering him, and it was too painful to continue sitting. The realities of the Buddha being a teacher and leader, and having to deal with, like when you read the suttas, then you have all these inspiring instructions and just people getting enlightened all over the place. They listen to the teachings and they delight in the Buddha's words, and they enter this stage of enlightenment or whatever. But then if you read the Book of Discipline on the monastic rules of conduct, you get a whole different picture of what the Buddha had to deal with. Because obstreperous, stubborn individuals who are constantly creating problems, arguing and fighting, or just downright dumb. That couldn't have been fun. But it wasn't a source of dukkha. a certain effort, attention, and you know, difficulty that the Buddha had to deal with, but ceasing to create a problem around it, ceasing to make it complicated. And then this cessation of suffering is also around, has that flavor as well. So that too, because sometimes we have an idyllic conceiving of what we think we should be attaining or realizing. And, you know, it's worth bringing that into clear investigation. We almost have a utopian conception of what somebody, you know, what enlightenment would be like. And it's really helpful to have a bigger picture, and to be able to still put the effort into the path, put the effort into the investigation and reflection, into the training, but to have a really realistic understanding of what we're practicing for. And that these Four Noble Truths are the appropriate framework for developing our practice. And so that investigating what is the experience around the things we come into contact with, whether it's external or internal, what is the flavor of it, what is being added to it in terms of some form of desire, expectation, clinging. Is there another layer that we're adding to it, and how to relinquish that? How to develop the path of practice so that we're able to relinquish to grasp, to hold. So that paying attention to this, the methodology of these Four Noble Truths, and the Buddha uses an image of practicing the path. He said it's as if someone had was in, say, in need of, wanted oil, needed some oil, like some cooking oil, and then they got a bunch of gravel and they put it into a tub, and then they pounded it and they poured water on it and they pressed it they didn't get oil. Because it just doesn't have they went through the right motions, but didn't quite have the ingredients right. So that relying on these, the practice of the path, relying on these. And if someone were in, wanted oil or needed oil, then you get a bunch of sesame seeds and you put it in a tub and you press it, you pour water on it, you pound it, you press it again, and you end up with oil. You're you're fulfilling all of the steps. And that's where the taking the time to really reflect carefully on how to apply these Four Noble Truths, how to make them meaningful, how to make them useful for oneself, and returning to this theme of investigation and contemplation another image that the Buddha uses is of somebody who wants milk, and they go to a cow, and of course, cows give milk, but then they twist the horn, and it doesn't quite work. They got the cow right, but you need to do it in the right way, so that with our practice. And reviewing and investigating, and if there is an experience of dukkha, if there is an experience of suffering, of stress, then that in itself, rather than it being a, because oftentimes what we take it as is there's many ways that we take it as, either it's just some obstacle that we're being beset by. Or it's a confirmation of our inability to be real spiritual practitioners. All of the permutations that come around a sense of self, a sense of me, but the experience of dukkha is to be taken up as a noble truth that is giving us an opportunity for insight and understanding. It's giving us the opportunity to practice and to relinquish. So rather than picking it up and carrying it around to bludgeon oneself with, and to pick it up as a theme of contemplation, as an investigation, so that we have that, we give ourselves the opportunity for these Four Noble Truths to unfold and to culminate in an experience of cessation, of freedom from suffering. And again, this is taking these noble truths, and rather than just trying to conform to them, one takes them up with a sense of interest. And exploring, what does it mean? What are they? How to use it? And what meaning? What value do they have for me? The Buddha is not trying to get us to to blindly conform to his teachings. He's trying to give us tools that will allow us to understand ourselves and ourselves within this human predicament of dukkha, and to be able to free ourselves from that. One of the things that comes to mind is there's a very highly respected teacher, disciple of Ajahn Mun. He's passed away, but he had his own formulation of the Four Noble Truths, and it's kind of unique to him, but I think really a a very useful tool for practice and contemplation. Is how he phrased it would be the lining up the Four Noble Truths, and the mind going outside, or outside of itself, is the cause, is samudaya, is the cause of suffering. The result of the mind going outside of itself is suffering itself. So he switches the truth around. Second truth first, in second place, in terms of cause first, the result after. So the result of the mind going outside of itself, the movement of the mind going out, is suffering itself. That is dukkha. As soon as the mind moves out of its base, moves out of itself, in time, sort of jitso nok. And as soon as that, the mind going outside, as soon as it does that, it will result in suffering. It's a natural result of suffering. And the third truth is that the mind, seeing the mind, or the mind knowing the mind, is the path, and the result of the mind knowing the mind is nirodha, is cessation of suffering, is ending of suffering. So it's a very useful tool, simple tool in our practice, taking those Four Noble Truths and investigating what the mind is doing, what is the way that the mind is where it's moving to, how it's moving, and learning to recognize those patterns, and then also the kind of the confidence that one gains of just allowing the mind to rest within itself, the mind knowing the mind, the mind seeing the mind, not being compelled to be searching for some distraction, whether it's just some toward the senses or towards conceiving of one's own within the sense of a self, of me, that bhavatanha, vipavatanha. So the using these Four Noble Truths in a practical way in our practice. Highlighting the realm of our experience, and taking the point of because sometimes we're looking for the pleasurable, the peaceful, the kind of the sublime. And just by the Buddha encouraging us to pay attention to that point of where there is some dis-ease, there is some discontent, to learn to look at it, and that is a noble truth. And so it's like if one is a naturalist and wanting and living in going out to a forest somewhere and wanting to find out what animals are in that forest, you don't run around the forest trying to count everything. You sit quietly at the place where there's either a water source, a spring, or a salt lick or something like that, and all the animals will go there. So similarly, if we kind of run around trying to figure everything out, trying to learn all the teachings, it's not a bad thing to do, but it's tiring, and it's much more fruitful to pick a point of investigation, pick a point of clarity, pick a point of where the experience comes together, and that point is around that the experience of dukkha, and to not be either intimidated or resentful of dukkha. It's shining a light on the whole realm of our experience. What are our habits? What's our conditioning? What is our the way our preferences work? You see that through this the light of investigation of dukkha. So, using the meditation. And this is where it's really helpful to, the conjunction and the mutual support of the peaceful mind to reflection and investigation. As the mind becomes more steady and clear, one starts to investigate these Four Noble Truths without it ending up just being a discursive proliferation. It's an investigation into experience. So one didn't have to think about it a whole lot, but one can contemplate it. One can understand it without getting entangled in the intellectual machinations that the mind can throw up, so that using the meditation, mindfulness of breathing, that establishing of a continuity of awareness on the breath, that's the place of work. That's where your duty is to looking after the meditation object, allowing the mind to become more steady, more consistent in its awareness, fostering the clarity that comes from that peacefulness of mind. But then there's also that contemplation that goes on. There's a discourse where the Buddha speaks about the, say, fivefold right concentration. And he describes standard sort of description of the four jhanas, but then the fifth factor of the fivefold right concentration is that the practitioner has the theme of reflection well in hand, well pondered, well contemplated. There one is looking after that theme of reflection, so that there's that in that way, then it leads to penetration, leads to understanding, and this is a factor of what the Buddha is saying. This is what right concentration looks like. Because sometimes there's the way that desire works is that it always wants more. And when you, and of course, you can see that mundane things, but we usually don't recognize it when we're meditating, and the mind starts to become a little bit peaceful, and you know it want, and it's, why wouldn't it want more? it's very rational, in the sense, more peace would be a good thing. But that's where that necessity of, in conjunction with our developing of the meditation object and the concentration practices, that we're reflecting and investigating at the same time. We're using those themes of reflection so that they're well considered, well pondered, well penetrated, well in hand. They're not one, because sometimes we defer that contemplation until my mind gets peaceful enough. Of course, peaceful enough, and I'm not sure where that is, because desire always conceives of it could be a bit more peaceful. So then we end up, then the bell goes. So that learning how to develop that balance, and oftentimes people would ask, most of us, and when we lived with Ajahn Chah, we would ask, there's always one of us asking, how much concentration do we need for the practice? And he said, you need enough concentration to be able to contemplate. And that's, and he wouldn't define it by some external standard. He would always say, the mind needs to be peaceful enough to be able to reflect skillfully. When the mind reflects skillfully, it will tend to become more peaceful. The process feeds itself. They're mutually supportive aspects of this practice. And of course, it's the viewing things through the lens of these Four Noble Truths that is very crucial and critical for the practice to really go forward and be meaningful. Because then both our concentration practice, samatha practice, as well as our investigative and contemplative practice, has a unifying structure. It has these Four Noble Truths to knit it together and take us to a place of understanding and relinquishment to peace. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning.